at this person right here. Credit card declined. If we can please have an awkward silence.
Oh, with a date here. Look, so I'm late on a few payments. I'll make it up next month. Promise.
He promises to pay it all back next month. Can we have an aww?
Putting more on your card than you can afford to spend can lead to even bigger problems, like public humiliation. Don't let your credit put you in a bad place. Go to controlyourcredit.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Treasury and the Ad Council.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are live this, January 2nd now, 2009, our second broadcast of the new year. If you are listening between 2 and 3 in the afternoon Pacific time, then you are hearing a broadcast that is in progress as you hear it, and one which is ready to be shaped by your phone calls, actually. If you have a question about the Bible, or about Christianity, and you'd like to ask it here, I would be glad to talk to you about it. And if you disagree with me about something you've heard, I'd be glad to talk to you about that, too. Feel free to call and disagree. The number to call is 1-800-438-5090. That is 1-800-438-5090. And I'd be glad to hear from you in the coming hour. And we have a couple lines open right now if you're interested in taking one of them. We have a call from Frank in Santa Cruz, California. And, Frank, good to hear from you.
Hey, Steve, Happy New Year.
Thank you. Same to you, brother.
All right. Hey, I wanted to fulfill your request to have somebody call in and disagree with you.
Good.
Yesterday you answered a question about the antiquity of Job, the book of
yes.
Job. And I'm a little surprised the way you answered it. Because you did come to the conclusion that it's probably older than Genesis. And my theory about Genesis is probably not just mine, I know at least a few other people that have it, is that it was not actually authored by Moses, but simply compiled, and no doubt edited somewhat, but that the original source material he got from elsewhere. And of course, the evidence for that, or at least two pieces of evidence, are the Toledoths in the book. There's about 11 of them that come at the beginning or end of various stories or genealogies that look like citations that Moses was giving to his sources. And then we also have the description of the landscape before the flood, which would be of absolutely no use to us today, because the flood probably destroyed all the evidence. And of course, that description is in chapter 2.
Yeah, good point.
So it looks to me like the authors were probably like most of the rest of the authors of the Bible. They seem largely to be eyewitnesses, at least for the historical events, eyewitnesses or careful interviewers of eyewitnesses, like Luke was, or careful historians, like during the Chronicles and the Kings. But, of course, that was probably multiple authorship. But people very familiar with the contemporary events. And I don't know of any other portion of the Bible that we could say that God just inspired somebody with a huge number of very detailed, very many details about things past. And in that case, it was actually something like 2,500 years of past occurrences. So it seems like, to be consistent with the rest of the Bible, Genesis was probably originally authored also by eyewitnesses or careful interviewers. And that, for example, going all the way back to the beginning, the very first people that would have needed at least the content of Genesis 1, whether it was written or stated verbally, would be Adam and Eve themselves. After all, their arrival brand new on this planet with no memory of anything in the past, since there wasn't a past. And they would have woken up and looked around and wondered, how in the world did I get here? And who am I? And so on. So that's, of course, exactly what are some of the questions that the Bible is intended to answer. And it seems like Genesis 1 would have been their answer.
Yeah, I don't disagree with anything you said. In fact, I hold the same view that Moses put together the book of Genesis from pre-existing documents, and that the names of those documents are found in the book itself, where it says the generations of,
right,
you know, Seth, or the generations of the sons of Noah, or the generations of whoever. Those are, I believe, acknowledgments of the either the beginning or the ending of a document. Different scholars have different opinions as to whether the document that goes by that name follows that notification or precedes it, and I don't know that I have a strong opinion one way or the other about that. But I believe there's at least 10 documents from which the book of Genesis was compiled by Moses. Now, when I said that I believe that Job could have been written before Genesis, when I say Genesis, I mean Genesis as we have it as a book now. I agree with you that Moses probably took whatever liberties he felt necessary to amend or edit the materials he presented, and the book of Genesis is a compilation that Moses made, and in its present form came from Moses. I did not necessarily discuss the sources of Genesis and how old they were, but I can see that my statements could be taken either way.
Yeah. I think since you talked about Job as possibly having been written down by Job himself originally, but perhaps not in poetic form, and then later redacted to become poetic, that you were acknowledging both the original potential authorship of it and the final redaction of it. And I thought that in the context of Genesis needed to be discussed in the same terms.
Well, that's a good point. You got me there.
Certainly in that viewpoint, Genesis itself would be the oldest book, or at least most of Genesis would predate Job in terms of original authorship.
Yeah, you got me there. I guess I was inconsistent in that way, because I was thinking of Genesis as a finished product, and I made a distinction in the case of Job between the finished product and the original document. So
right.
I wasn't being completely consistent there.
Yeah, well, since you and I have talked about it before, and I thought we were in sync in our understanding, I just wanted to clarify that point.
Yeah, good point. Very good point. And valuable, because I agree with you that the book of Genesis did not start with Moses. That is, Moses was not the beginning of the literary material there, but I think that it goes all the way back to Adam and Eve themselves.
Yeah, and a related point, by the way, data on that same point, is that the only way we would even know that Moses had anything to do with Genesis is that the five books are referred to, the Pentateuch, are referred to as the books of Moses.
Right.
But, of course, that doesn't exclude the fact that although he was eyewitness of the events that are described in the other four, since he wasn't eyewitness to the events of Genesis, his being simply the compiler and editor to put the material together in a useful form to go along with the other four books would certainly qualify that book to still be referred to as the book of Moses, even though he shouldn't be thought of as the original author.
Yeah, like Jesus said to the Jews, did not Moses give you the law?
Yes.
And he could be referring to the whole Torah there, the five books of Moses, which would be the normal way for the Jews to speak of the law, but he might also be only referring to the legislation.
Of course, Moses, even if Moses was the compiler of Genesis, he was still the giver of that book also.
Right.
It's just that he was not the original author of it. Let's see, it seems like there was one other point I wanted to make. Oh, the other point is that Jesus does quote things out of the other four books and attribute them to Moses.
But not Genesis.
Never, when he quotes out of Genesis, which he does significantly, and you know, certainly about marriage in the first two chapters, he does not ascribe those comments to Moses.
And that could be very significant. Yeah.
Yeah, could be. I mean, it doesn't make things definitive for us, but it's all a matter of speculation. But there is evidence to go along with it, and since there's no proof of any other authorship, then that's probably as good a theory as any.
Yeah, those are all very excellent points.
All right.
I especially liked the one about the geography of the first two chapters being in, you know, not like the geography after the flood, which means the description of it must have been written before the flood.
Right. Only somebody that was there at that time would be able to know that. Of course, it's also true that very obviously only someone who was there could have told us what went on in the first 6 days, too. And
of course, there was
only one person there.
That's right. And so I know your theory is that the very first of those documents, which contains chapter 1 and what the first three verses of chapter 2 of Genesis, actually may have been written by God's own hand.
Yeah, quite possibly, because as I said earlier, certainly Adam and Eve needed that information just as badly as any other human beings did,
yeah,
to know where they came from and so forth. And it is possible that God used that as the first writing lesson.
Yeah,
he might have either taught Adam and Eve to write, or at least showed them writing and explained it to them, explained how they could pick up on it and start writing. Now, of course, most secular scholars don't think writing went back that far, or think it was highly primitive at that point.
Right.
But that's fairly typical in their viewpoint. Anyway, they have kind of an arrogant viewpoint that we moderns know so much more than any of the ancients ever possibly did.
Yeah, there's certainly no evidence that writing was not in existence at that time. In fact, there was a time not so very long ago that critical scholars said that Moses couldn't have written any of the Bible because there was not writing invented even in his day,
right,
which is only 1400 BC, you know.
Right. Yeah.
But then they found the laws of Hammurabi, which predated Moses by about 600 years, you know, and elaborate libraries of writings from the time of Abraham, 2,000 years B.C., and it kind of, they had egg on their faces. And now they must push the invention of writing at least back that far, but who can say how much further back it goes?
Yes, that's right. Well, they keep getting egg on their face by trying to prove negatives.
Well, you know, that is really sort of the history of anti-biblical scholarship, isn't it? I mean, you can find the books and the articles written by the critics, saying the Bible is wrong about this and that and the other thing, and then the trend has always been further archaeological discoveries have proven they were wrong in each case.
Right.
Seems like they learn.
So it seems to always pay off to just assume that the Bible knows what it's talking about.
So far it has paid off. So far, those who trust him wholly, you know, will not be ashamed, you know.
Yep. Even if you don't, even if you weren't to think of it as a wholly inspired document, just thinking of it as a history book, it has proven to be far and away the best and most accurate history book we've ever had.
Yeah, that's a fact. Especially, yeah, I mean, probably from any era, but especially the ancient eras.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yep. All right. Sounds good. Well, carry on and have a great new year.
Okay, thanks. I'm glad you made it through the transition to the new year, Frank, and you got another year to work on here.
Yep, that we do.
All right, God bless you.
God bless you. Bye.
Bye now. All right, well, our lines are open right now. If you'd like to be on the program, you're listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast, and we are a live question and answer program, or if you don't have a question but you have a disagreement with the host, feel free to call. And that disagreement can be whether you're a Christian, like Frank is, and sees maybe some things he feels he disagrees with things I said, or if you're not even a Christian, maybe you're even an anti-Christian, and you'd like to say a few things about what you disagree with about Christianity or the Bible. You're welcome here. You're welcome here. We'll treat you with respect. Well, I don't know about how much respect. We won't necessarily respect everything you say. We might. Who knows? Depends on how well you say it and how valid it is. But we'll treat you with civility, and we can have a conversation. That's what I would enjoy very much if more people who are not Christians wanted to participate in this program. I know they're out there because occasionally I hear that they're listening. The number is 1-800-438-5090. 1-800-438-5090. Charles wrote in and asked, is Elijah going to come before Christ returns? Well, that is, I guess we could say, the common view of many Bible prophecy buffs, teachers, and so forth. I mean, the dispensational view holds, and the Jewish traditions hold that Elijah is going to come before the Messiah comes. Now, of course, one difference between the Christian view and the Jewish view is that the Christians believe the Messiah already has come. And yet, Christians believe there are two comings of the Messiah. Now, some Christians hold that the coming of Elijah will precede the second coming. Others hold that the coming of Elijah preceded the first coming. That would be my view. My view is that that Elijah showed up before the first coming of Christ, because that's essentially what Jesus said. Jesus said, if you can receive it, John the Baptist is Elijah who was to come. This is actually when the disciples asked him, why do the scribes say that Elijah must come first? Well, the reason the scribes said that is because there's a prophecy in the Old Testament. In fact, it's the last prophecy in the Old Testament. At the end of Malachi chapter 4, verses 5 and 6, God said he'll send Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and terrible day of the Lord, and he'll prepare the way of the Lord, and so forth. Well, Jesus told the disciples, if you can receive it, John is that fulfillment of that prophecy. John is Elijah who was to come. And so Jesus seemed to understand Elijah had already come in the person of John the Baptist and was the fulfillment of that prophecy. And if that is true, of course, and I believe it is, because I always believe whatever Jesus says, if I can understand it, well, then there's no necessary reason to postulate a second coming of Elijah. Elijah doesn't necessarily have to come before Jesus comes back. At least that would be what I would draw from Jesus' words there. Let's talk to Todd, calling from Salinas, California next. Hi, Todd. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hi. Hi, Greg. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
Long time no talk. Anyway, I just have a question for you. Just your comment. I don't know. Let's see here. In Mark 14, verse, let's see here, 51, about the young man.
Yep.
What's your thoughts on that? I don't have any thought, or I've never heard anybody really talk about that. It's just
really
a little bit bizarre.
It's very. That's the word I was going to use. It is bizarre. Well, let me read it for the sake of those who aren't familiar with it. This is in the story of Jesus being betrayed in the Garden of Gethsemane, when Judas came and betrayed him, and the soldiers arrested Jesus. The disciples all ran away. Now, this is recorded in several of the Gospels, but only Mark records this little detail. This is in the Garden of Gethsemane when Jesus was arrested. Verse 51 of chapter 14 says, now a certain young man followed him, having a linen cloth thrown around his naked body, and the young man laid hold of him, that is, the young men, the soldiers laid hold of this man, and he left the linen cloth and fled from them naked. So here we have a young man. In addition to the disciples, this young man is in the Garden of Gethsemane watching this whole thing transpire when Jesus is arrested. This young man is wearing nothing at all, but he's wrapped in a bed sheet. Now, one of the soldiers tries to grab him, but they end up holding the sheet, and he ends up running into the bushes without clothing on. Bizarre, yeah, to say the least, it is a bizarre story. And the question, of course, is not only who is the young man, but why is it recorded, for one thing? And why was this man wearing nothing but a bedsheet? Now, the theory that I think most responsible biblical scholarship has held is that the young man was Mark himself, and that this is his way of subtly making his own confession that he too had abandoned Jesus at the time of Jesus' arrest, which is sort of a confession of his own cowardice. Now, why would it be marked? Well, there is at least a scenario that can be suggested that makes some sense. Jesus and the disciples sometimes met, it would appear, in Mark's mother's house. Mark was a young man, apparently living at home with his folks, and his mother's house was a meeting place for Christians. We know that in the book of Acts. That's where a prayer meeting was being held at the time that Peter was sprung from prison by an angel in Acts chapter 12, Mark's mother's house. It was apparently one of the meeting places, maybe one of the primary meeting places of the early Christians in Jerusalem. Now, it is also possible, though no one knows for sure, it's possible that that is where Jesus had the Lord's Supper, the Last Supper, in the upper room. It could have been at Mark's mother's house. If Mark's parents were followers of Jesus, or Mark's mother was a follower of Jesus, she may have shown hospitality to the disciples of Jesus before the crucifixion as well as after. We know she did afterward. It may have been a meeting place of theirs even when Jesus was alive. And therefore, it is suggested that perhaps during the Last Supper, that may have been held upstairs at Mark's mother's house. Mark himself may have been in bed, sleeping, or maybe not quite sleeping. And knowing very well that Jesus was a wanted man and that there were, you know, warrants out for his arrest, it may have been a tense situation. When Jesus left with his disciples, Mark, out of curiosity, may have wanted to follow along and see where they were going and see what would happen to Jesus. But if he had been in bed, he might have been wearing nothing at all and just grabbed his bed sheet to wrap around himself and to follow in the distance to the garden, sort of to spy on him. And, you know, it's not likely that he'd be in their midst walking in a bed sheet. But if he was following out of curiosity and had to hurry along because they were getting out of sight, so he grabbed whatever was near to him to cover his naked body and went with them, then that might explain how he happened to be there in the garden dressed in nothing but a bed sheet. And his flight would be recorded by Mark and by none of the other gospel writers only because Mark is writing it, and Mark is perhaps making a confession of his own failure to stand by Jesus in his time of need. That is a scenario that has been suggested and which seems to cover all the bases, though there's absolutely nothing in the Bible to tell us that that's the right answer.
Could it have been an angel?
I don't think so, but I mean, I'm not sure why an angel would be dressed in a sheet.
Mm-hmm. I'm just, you know, I don't know either. It just was one of those, it's one of those places in the Bible that, I mean, was always curious to me. Also the part where Mary thought that Jesus was the gardener, it always struck me as, I don't know, sort of curious, but I'm not going to lose any sleep over it one way or the other. But anyway, thank you so much, and I appreciate your show. God bless you.
Okay, Todd, thanks for your call. Let's talk to John next from Santa Cruz, California. John, welcome to The Narrow Path.
Good afternoon, Steve.
Hey, twice in 1 week? Or?
Well, I'm on holiday, so I get,
okay.
I get a chance to call you.
Good to hear from you.
Yeah. Hey, I've been reading through Matthew, and I've started keeping a little record of the prophecies that Matthew has been using, evidently, as he's targeting his Jewish audience. And I came to, like, the seventh prophecy that I'm counting out of, it's in Matthew chapter 2, and it says, let's see, so what was fulfilled was said through the prophets, he will be called a Nazarene. This is when Joseph and Mary decided to go back to Nazareth instead of Bethlehem or Judea. So, but then as I'm looking in the notes, there's no reference to the Old Testament.
That's correct.
In terms of that prophecy. So what's your take on where did that prophecy come from?
Okay, yeah, there is no Old Testament prophecy that says he shall be called a Nazarene, and yet Matthew cites it as if it's an Old Testament prophetic fulfillment. Well, notice in that chapter, there are several other references to prophecies being fulfilled. In verse 5 and 6, it says, for thus it is written in the prophet, and then he quotes Micah about the Bethlehem birth of Jesus.
Right.
Then in verse 15, it says, which was spoken by the Lord through the prophet, saying, out of Egypt I called my son, a quotation from Hosea 11:1. And then we have in verses 17 and 18, it was spoken by Jeremiah the prophet, saying, and there, of course, he quotes from Jeremiah 31:15. But notice in all those cases, it says this was prophesied by the prophet, singular. But in verse 23, it says, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by the prophets, plural.
Right.
He should be called a Nazarene. So what's strange about this is that in each of the other cases, there is a specific prophet who is being quoted. And it says, you know, the prophet said this. But here we have a statement that this statement, he should be called Nazarene, is something that was prophesied by the prophets, plural. In other words, he's not making a reference to any one prophet, but this idea was found in more than one prophet in the Old Testament.
So then now, was it oral tradition through the prophets?
That's not my opinion. I suppose it's a possibility, but there are a couple of things that have been suggested otherwise. One of them is that and this is the one I do not favor. One of them is that the word Nazarene had a negative connotation. Remember when Nathaniel said, can anything good come out of Nazareth?
Uh-huh.
That a Nazarene or someone from Nazareth was considered to be, you know, like a
hillbilly.
A hillbilly, yeah, yeah, exactly. And therefore, that Matthew is referring to the fact that many of the prophets, at least several of the Old Testament prophets, made reference to Jesus being spoken of scornfully, being rejected, being looked down upon. And when it turned out that Jesus became a Nazarene and would be called a Nazarene, that as a term of contempt, more or less,
uh-huh.
Matthew saw this as kind of a fulfillment of the general theme of the Old Testament prophets, that he would be looked upon with disdain. And therefore, as he was called a Nazarene, this seemed to fulfill a theme of the prophets. That's not my view. That is a view I've heard expressed. And one reason it's not my view is there actually is no evidence anywhere in the Bible or outside the Bible that the term Nazarene was a term of contempt. It is true that Nathaniel said, can anything good come out of Nazareth? With reference to when Philip told him that Jesus was the Messiah from Nazareth. But that doesn't mean that Nazareth itself was considered to be a bad place. There's no other place in the Bible or outside the Bible that would suggest this. Rather, Nathanael and Philip were both themselves Galileans, and Nazareth was a place in Galilee. And one would have expected the Messiah to come from someplace in Judea, from Jerusalem or something like that, a more prestigious place. And when Nathanael said, can any good thing come out of Nazareth, he may have been actually speaking relatively humbly. He and Philip and Jesus were all from Galilee, and Nazareth was part of Galilee, and he might be saying, can any good thing come out of Nazareth, which is a city in Galilee, instead of someplace like Jerusalem
right.
or Judea? So, I mean, there's really no evidence that the town that Jesus came from was lightly regarded or lowly regarded. So that explanation doesn't seem to work for me. But there is another, and that is that the word Nazareth, from which the word Nazarene, the word Nazarene means someone from Nazareth, Nazareth comes from the Hebrew word netzer, which means branch. The word Nazareth actually means the town of the branch.
Huh.
Now, there's a number of Old Testament prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Zechariah, who refer to the Messiah as the branch.
Yes, Isaiah 11, verse 1, it does refer me to that.
Uh-huh, and there are multiple references in the prophets. Like I say, Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Zechariah all make reference to the Messiah. One of his titles is the branch. Now, that would possibly explain what Matthew's thinking here. He's thinking, well, listen, Jesus, who the prophets, of course, referred to as the branch, here he comes to live in the town of the branch.
Uh-huh.
And Nazareth, the town of the branch. And so, in a sense, he shall be called a Nazarene would only mean he will be called someone from the town of the branch, which is not an actual statement of the Old Testament. But in the fact that he is the branch, and it was his town, Matthew may be seeing some kind of what many would think a tenuous connection. But I would compare it with this. We know, for example, and the Bible doesn't make this point, but we know that the name Bethlehem means the house of bread. Well, Jesus is the bread of life. A person might say, well, isn't that interesting? The house of bread, Bethlehem, Jesus, the bread of life, comes from Bethlehem. And, you know, someone might make that connection and even see it as a divinely intended connection without, you know, the Bible doesn't do that, but it would be the same kind of thing as saying, well, look, he came to live in Nazareth. He was a Nazarene. The prophet said he'd be the branch, didn't they? Well, this is the town of the branch. And so this is how many people, I think probably is correct, how Matthew was thinking about that.
Okay. So you do liken it to the branch. And as I read Isaiah 11, it talks about, I think it talked about coming out of the stump of Jesse.
Yeah, well, in Isaiah 11, 1 it does, yeah.
Yeah, so, okay, that makes sense to me. Thank you. And the other question, only other one more question is, have you ever done a specific teaching, and you know how interested I am in this, on typology between the Old Testament and the New Testament?
I don't think I've done a topical teaching on that. In my introductions to the Old Testament, I sometimes have a section of the lecture where I talk about types, but I haven't really done a thorough lecture on the whole subject of typology in the Old Testament.
Okay. I'll just keep searching.
Okay, John. It's good to hear from you, brother.
Yeah, you too. It's good to hear your voice.
All right.
Okey-doke.
Bye now. All right, our next caller is, I believe, our atheist friend, Christopher. Hi, Christopher. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Happy New Year, Steve.
Hey, same to you. Hey, you've tried to call a few times and not gotten on because you all called at the end of a program. We ran out of time, I think.
No, yeah, I apologize. I tried to get in there around the beginning so I could get in.
Actually, I was apologizing to you that you didn't get on. But we'll just, okay, we'll exchange apologies and let bygones be bygones.
Fantastic. Hey, you're coming up to Portland in January?
Yes, I'll be speaking in, actually, McMinnville 2 weeks from tonight. And then I'll be in Camas, Washington the next night, Saturday night. And by the way, in McMinnville, which I think is that the 17th? I think it's the 17th of this month, or 16th. I'm going to be speaking on the subject of the reliability of the Gospels in light of modern-day media challenges. Things like...
I like that subject.
Yeah. I'm going to be comparing it with the Zeitgeist movie and with Da Vinci Code, those kind of theories about Christianity.
Oh, man, I would really love to catch that. I will try to... I've actually had some car trouble, but I will try to work. I at least want to try to see if... I said it by your lunch. I do have a couple of quick questions for you. I'll send you an email.
Okay.
Couple of quick ones. The first is you, on your website, you had some comic books. You drew those?
Yes.
Yeah. Do you still draw stuff like that, or are you still, do you still use that talent?
Only on napkins in restaurants.
Yeah.
Actually, I have not drawn cartoons for quite a few years, though my cartooning career spanned several decades. It was very seldom the main thing I was doing. I mean, I was always teaching. A lot of that time I was playing in a Christian rock band, and in my spare time, I was drawing Christian comic books and tracks.
Yeah, you seem to have a good drawing ability. I just thought, maybe you should do a little of that here and there, because it seems like you don't do it anymore. I was just throwing out suggestions.
As you can, now you're an artist yourself, a painter, and so you can probably tell I'm using an old medium. I just use pen and ink, and I don't even use brushes or colors. I'm not very versatile.
I like it.
Really? Because it seems to me like all the modern cartoons must utilize computer graphics or something like that, which I don't know anything about.
Yeah, pretty much all color and everything, it's all done through computers. I think inking is the only thing that's still done in the traditional style. And I was kind of wondering, is that something that, for a Christian, if you have a talent like that, is there some sort of obligation to use it?
Well, that's a good question. You know, the Christian believes that whatever assets we have, whether it's talents or connections, money, any number of things, whatever may be considered to be an advantage in life, even if someone has good looks or something like that, anything that can be brokered for influence is really something that God has given to the Christian or to the person to be managed for God, to be stewarded. It's a stewardship. And stewardship just means management for an owner. And God's the owner. So I believe that if a Christian can use music or art or any other talent they have for the kingdom of God, I do believe they have some obligation to do it. Some people may not have the opportunity. And if you're wondering whether I'm obligated to keep drawing comic books, I don't know. I have definitely tried to use every talent that I've imagined myself to have in one way or another to promote the kingdom of God, and I would be glad to draw more comic books if I had the time to do everything in the whole world. If I could clone myself a few times, I'd be doing music and art and teaching and writing.
Yeah, I was just interested in that. They look really good, and I was curious about the obligations of talent. I guess I'm assuming that talent comes, gets something from God that he.
Well, I certainly believe so, and I have a lot of other comic books in my head. I actually considered putting out scores of them, but I just didn't have the time once I got busy with other things.
Yeah, it's really.
But all the other things, see, I actually try to manage my time and my talents in such a way as to give the most of my time to that which I think will have the greatest impact.
Right.
And, but I don't like to leave anything untouched. But fortunately, something like comic books, they're in print. They're perpetually in print. You know, it's like I don't have to redo them all the time. Whereas a radio program, I have to talk to people day by day, which I like to do.
And nowadays, what's great too is if you just went through the time of creating them, like which you're very aware of with all your free content, is now you can, you know, pretty much publish it digitally online, and people can snatch it up. So
that's right. Yeah, and I don't know if you found out, but you can, people can download those comic books in a format that's book format, where they can put it together for themselves and staple them. Actually, we have hard copies of those books still sitting, thousands of them, in cartons in a storage unit here in Santa Cruz. But we haven't distributed them for years, and one of the reasons is in the back cover, the address for people to contact us is an address that hasn't been current for over 8 years.
Wow.
And so there's thousands of these books sitting around with the wrong address on them, and that's the only reason I don't distribute them.
Yeah, well, you'll have to remedy that sometime. I wouldn't mind getting one of those.
I'll bring you some.
I would like that. And I have kind of a personal question, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Because I know you, all the donations for your ministry go towards the ministry. And I was kidding, do you have another job?
No. No, I have no guaranteed income from any source. I'm glad you asked that, because as a non-believer yourself, I love to testify about this thing. You know, for 40 years, almost 40 years, I've been in the ministry. And when I went in the ministry, I decided I would never make a job of it. I would never make it a money-making profession. I figured that as long as somebody is paying a minister a paycheck, that minister must be serving that master.
So how do you pay your bills? You have an apartment or something, I presume.
Yeah, well, my bills are pretty slight because I live pretty modestly, but I've raised 5 kids and I've owned 2 houses and I have no debt. And I can testify that God has taken care of all my needs. But to tell you the truth, I don't know where the money is going to come from. If I would look back at where the money has come from, let's say last month and the month before and so forth, it comes from a variety of places.
So is it a type of thing where somebody maybe that wants to that would say, hey Steve, I really like what you do, I like your teaching and stuff. Let me help you out a little this month. Is it kind of like a,
yeah, that's very common, very common. In fact, in today's mail there was some very generous help to me personally. You see, if people send money to the narrow path, I don't get any of that because I don't take any salary or anything from any. But some people, and it, like today's mail, there were a few of these. So people sent a check to the Narrow Path and a separate check to me by name, and it's when that happens that I get income from that. I also get a very small royalty check twice a year on my book, my Revelation book. The book sells for $32 in stores. I get about $1 a copy, and it's not a bestseller, so I get a little money that way, and I also travel and speak, and usually, when I travel and speak, there's an honorarium. Last time I traveled to Europe, I paid my own way. I didn't receive an honorarium because the people I spoke for were too poor. But that happens sometimes. I don't mind that. I speak for free, and I never charge.
Oh, you don't charge?
No, I never charge. I'll travel anywhere in the world if I can afford to get there and speak for free. But a lot of the places I speak do give an honorarium. which is an unpredictable amount, sort of a gift they give. So some of my income comes that way.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, fair enough. I'm not, I figured it was along those lines. I was just curious. So you ever late a month?
Late, on my finances?
Yeah. Do you ever, I always have to have, actually,
well,
I'm always,
I love to talk about this.
I would just go crazy not knowing if I didn't have any money to pay rent, you know?
Well, that's why I love to talk about this, because to me, it's just a testimony that God is real. Because I never am unable to pay my rent, though there are many times once I've paid my rent, there's no money left. In fact, probably that's probably been the case more often than not. I mean, when my bills are paid, there's usually no surplus, but there's never any lack. And what's interesting, too, is I don't have, you know, a number of people that I don't have a mailing list. I don't send out a newsletter. I don't tell anybody when I have a particular need. I made a decision 40 years ago that I would just tell God about that. And He, if He's real, He'll take care of my needs like He said He would. He said, seek first the kingdom of God and His righteousness and all these things we added to you. And so that's how I've lived for that many years. And month by month, every bill of mine has been paid. And always, no 2 months are alike as far as who sends money or how many times I speak and receive an honor. I mean, every month is different, but the amazing thing is that almost every month, just the exact amount I need comes. And almost, I don't have any savings. I don't have insurance or savings, but I've never cared about that. I believe God is real. I'm not a practitioner of any religion. I'm not a religious guy. I just have a relationship with a real God. And I serve Him, and He always supports His servants.
Oh, that's interesting.
As a non-believer yourself, I'm sure that must be perplexing, but even Christians often are perplexed by it.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a certain kind of, it's not a very common approach.
Well, I do it for two reasons, maybe three. One reason I do it is I believe that's how Jesus did and the apostles. I don't believe they ever had anyone paying them a paycheck. I don't think they ever raised finances for themselves. I've never read of it. I don't think it'd be in character for Jesus to do that. So that's one reason I do that. Another is that I want it to be a testimony. I want to be able to tell people truthfully, there is a God and you can't explain my survival anyway, except by the God hypothesis, you know? I mean, there's coincidences just would not explain it adequately. And the third reason I do it is because I like miracles. And, you know, I don't have a miracles ministry. Some people, you know, they pray for the sick and they get well. I'm not one of those people. I don't see a lot of miracles that way. And I decided when I went into the ministry, one miracle I could count on was God providing for me. It's a modest miracle. But if it happens 1,000 times a year, or 1,000 times in a decade, let's say, then it adds up to a lot of miraculous. And there's been tons of miraculous provisions that God has done over the years. And really, I could honestly say, I could not pay my rent, I could not do anything, if unpredictable gifts or something came up every month.
Well, it would be harder to do it without a radio show.
You know, but I did it for years without a radio show. I've been on the radio for 12 years, but I've been living this way since I was 16 or 17.
Hmm. Yeah, my uncle is dying of cancer. He's pretty much on his deathbed right now. We're kind of just waiting for him to pass, and I've been trying to talk to him a lot, and now he can't really talk very well, but the last long conversation we had was about atheism and God and stuff, and he's a Christian. And, wow, what an uncomfortable conversation, though. It's because he's dying, so it's not...
Yeah, but now he's a Christian. Does he seem to have peace about dying?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
I
think he's pretty young and stuff, but I think he's sort of preparing himself. It took him a while to actually go to a home where they take care of him. He was kind of fighting that for a while, but I think he knows that he's going. So, man, it was just a terrible conversation.
It would be hard, especially for someone like you who, you know, you don't have any assurance of where he's going.
I didn't want to make him feel bad or, you know, as a really, you know, I'm not, I was trying to tread lightly.
But death doesn't have to be an awkward subject for people who are believers in Christ. But I know that if someone doesn't believe in God or doesn't believe in Christ, it must be extremely awkward. And I would think terrifying.
Yeah, I just didn't know what to tell him. And I told him about your show, and I told him that we talk, and he thought that sounded great. He would love your show. He's, I don't know, he'd really like it. I wish he could hear it.
Does he live in the Portland area?
No, he lives in Southern California, and he's having trouble turning on the radio and doing everything.
But well, my friend.
Anyways, not to end on a down note. I will contact you soon about maybe trying to get some lunch or something.
Email me, and I'll make arrangements to see you. Probably Friday would be the best day for me.
Right.
2 weeks from today. But give me an email, and I will get back to you on that.
I will. Hey, enjoy the new year, my friend.
Thanks, Christopher. Good to hear from you.
All right, bud. Bye.
Bye now. As far as I know, Christopher's the only atheist who calls regularly and you know, just likes to chat and pick my brain. But I'm glad to have him or any number of non-Christians do the same thing here on the show. Or Christians, as I assume most of my callers are. Teresa from Portland, Oregon, you are next. Welcome.
Hi, Steve. That was great. I'm listening to you visit with him. And, gosh, I'd almost like to leave a number and give him a ride out to McMinnville.
Yeah, well, you can email me.
I will do that. Hey, Steve, my question today is about angels. I have a friend who I pray with, and she just moves angels around like chess pieces. And I don't know if we're supposed to do that. And I have never had any specific and direct teaching about angels. I see them all over in the Bible, but I don't know what it is that we are to have to do with them directly and specifically, and if we have the authority to place them or to command them or to call them. It is just a broad kind of toss it out there.
Okay. Well, there is sort of a trend now. I know some New Agey types really get into angels these days, but, you know, there's obviously an overlap between that and Christianity, since Christianity says things about angels. The main thing about angels to note is that they are God's servants and God's messengers, and he sends them to do whatever he wants them to do. It is not ever suggested that Christians are to pray for angels to do a certain thing or to command angels to do anything. As a matter of fact, the early Christians and even Jesus himself never sought to converse with angels or give them orders or anything like that. The angels came when God wanted them to come. And the Christian, and even Jesus in his earthly life, Jesus received their ministry whenever his Father wanted to send them, but we don't have him ordering them around. Now, Jesus did say, when he was arrested in the garden, that if he wished, he could call on 12 legions of angels, and they would come and rescue him. But he didn't do it. Now, Jesus, of course, being God, had every right to order angels around, but we don't read of him ever doing it, even at a time where, you know, his life was in danger. We do find angels coming and letting Peter out of prison and doing things like that. But Peter didn't call them, didn't expect them. In fact, he was asleep when it happened, wasn't expecting company at all. So I would say that people who focus on angels are focusing on something the Bible does not encourage us to focus on. The Bible does say that the angel of the Lord encamps around about them that fear him and delivers them. So that is obviously stated for the purpose of making us feel some security that God has his troops, as it were, assigned to our safety. But we don't give them any specific orders or directions.
But it is that even though they are, like you say, assigned to us to give us a sense of security or that, I just have never even felt compelled to, you know, get into a relationship with my quote unquote, you know, angel that's watching over me. I've just always kind of figured that was God's job. And if God wanted to do whatever he wanted to do with them, so it's just difficult for me. I don't understand. And I could not, as she has spoken to me on different occasions, I've kind of just let it go by because I cannot rack in my brain, aside from what you were speaking of about Peter having an encounter with the angel, and like you said, he didn't ask for it. I cannot rack in my brain, what is the scriptural background behind having that kind of authority? And I cannot find it. And so I thought, well, I don't know. I'll call you and see if you can.
Well, some people would say that we Christians have, of course, the authority of Christ because we are members of His body. We are sons of God, whereas angels are only servants of God.
Okay.
And therefore, it does say in 1 Corinthians 6 that someday we will judge angels, which suggests that we may be holding, we have a status probably above theirs. But that doesn't translate into any kind of interaction with or relationship with angels that we would initiate. And I'm not sure why people would be fascinated with talking to angels when you could talk to God Himself.
Yeah.
I think God's a lot more exciting than an angel.
Yeah, well, boy, me too. And I sure don't want to see one. I think I would just fall apart like those cartoon characters that just break into a million pieces.
Well, most people actually respond that way. The first thing angels always say is, don't be afraid.
Don't be afraid. They don't say shout that to me. But even, you know, and as I was reflecting on that, I was thinking, but that was not how Peter responded to that angel, even though he thought he was asleep. He thought he was dreaming,
yeah.
Yeah, so I don't know. Anyway, I just wanted to kind of pick your brain a little bit for, you know, the general broad, you know, what you had to say about them.
Yeah.
I just cannot sort that out in my mind. So, well, thank you, Stephen. I'm hoping to see you either in McMinnville or Camas for sure.
Great. Well, if you want to send me a contact information, maybe I can put you in touch with Christopher for a ride.
I will. That would be great. I'd love to.
Okay. God bless you, Teresa.
Thank you, Steve. Bye-bye.
Bye now. All right. Let's talk last of all to Jim from Salinas, California. We only have a couple minutes left. Jim, welcome.
Yeah, Steve. I don't think we have time. I do this all the time. I'm sorry. I called a little late, but it's usually something that'll inspire me to call, you know, and I never know what time that's going to be. But it was stressed pretty much. And I kind of wanted to share a little of my testimony about how God has met my needs. But I don't think we have time, so I want to just tell you Happy New Year and God bless you.
Well, thank you, bro.
I always enjoy your conversations with Chris. You know, it's really, he sounds like a good guy. I mean, you know, you know, like he's got a lot of compassion in his heart and stuff, and, you know.
It's nice to know that all atheists are not like Richard Dawkins, you know.
Yeah.
That there are some nice ones.
Yes. I've met some in my time, too. And some of them display more, you know, goodness than a lot of Christians I've met. It's a fact, you know. And I've told a man, an old man that one time, that he was so dogmatic about being an atheist. I mean, he was almost evangelistic about it. You know, you get on the subject of God, and he was the nicest guy in the room so you could broach that subject.
Yeah, well, a lot of people who identify themselves as atheists actually do so because they are very bitter about religion.
Exactly. Yeah.
A lot of times, since even though there's no, you know, there's certainly no proof of atheism, not anything like there are the evidences of Christianity, but at the same time, people don't always want evidence. They sometimes, well, mostly people will believe what they want to believe unless they're incredibly honest, which is not very common among people. But
yes, I talked to a homeless man the other day that said that from what he's seen in this world, there couldn't be a God. And he's, I hear your music.
Yeah.
So he's misplacing the blame. You know, it's usually religion that has hurt people to that point. And
well, people do misunderstand. If people have had really hard lives and seen a lot of evil and injustice and they don't know God, they often wonder, how could there be a good God with all this going on? But I guess we'll have to discuss that another time.
Okay, brother. Well, I'll try to hook up on Monday.
All right, Jim. Good talking to you.
You have a blessed weekend. God bless.
You too. Bye now.
Bye now.
All right. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are a live broadcast Monday through Friday. Hope you'll make it a regular habit of listening and calling in when you have questions or comments that you'd like to make to me or our audience. The Narrow Path is a listener-supported ministry, and we don't sell anything. If you go to our website, you can't find anything for sale there. We don't have sponsors. We don't take commercial breaks. Everything we have at the website we give away for free, and that is true of the radio program also. We do this for free, but the radio stations need to be paid for the time, and so we do trust that God puts it on the hearts of people to help support that expense. And if you'd like to do that, you can write to us at this address. It's The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. That address can also be found at our website. There's even a PayPal link there if you want to make a contribution that way. And that's where you'll find all the free resources I mentioned. The website is www.thenarrowpath.com. That's thenarrowpath.com. My name is Steve Gregg. Thanks for joining us. Tune in again Monday, and we'll have another discussion. God bless.